Tip Today with Fran Curry.
With Slattery's Garage, puck on. Your Peugeot car or van might benefit from a free software upgrade. For more information and to find out if this applies to your vehicle, call the lads in Slattery's Garage, puck on 067 24111 or slatterysgarage.ie.
Thanks, Ali. Welcome back to the final hour of Tip Today. A lot of questions coming in for Karen, and we will store them up and we'll present them to Karen, and she can deal with them next time round. She's with us every fortnight, as you know. 083 311 3311, the text and WhatsApp, and of course you can speak to Leanne for free on 1800 938 007.
For every problem there's a solution. Dear Phil on Tip Today with Phil Prendergast.
And Phil is with me. Good morning to you, Phil.
Good morning, Fran.
Good to see you today. I was speaking to Cynthia Navarro earlier on. She's a candidate for Fianna Fáil in Ireland South for the European elections. And does this whet your appetite when you see all of this? Because you did all of that, Phil.
I did it all.
You went on the trail. You did all the interviews.
I did all that, but I have to say that I could not have done that had Alan Kelly not got elected to the Dáil, and Arthur Spring also getting elected at the same time, and I was third in line as a replacement. So my route to the European Parliament was very easy.
Yes.
And I did know that even though I had to contest it the next time out, I knew because Brian Crowley was still in office and still contesting, and Leon Arida and all those people. So I knew very realistically that even though I had to do the grunt work and the footwork, yeah, and pay out a lot of money, I was in a position to do it at the time because I had been there.
Yes.
So,
but you knew that even while you were canvassing, Phil.
Oh, yeah.
What was that difficult? Was that?
It's not difficult when you see. You just have to be honourable and do what needs to be done. And if you don't get a success in it, then you need to accept that and just say, well, you know what, I really did enjoy my time there, gave employment to a lot of people in the southeast, and it was a very, very exciting time and a very nice job, very tiring. Extraordinary the Strasbourg week, because you were travelling and you'd get back maybe at 1 o'clock in the morning, and then you have to think, oh, here I am home Friday, Saturday and Sunday, Monday morning going back again. But the Friday, Saturday and Sunday was, you try to keep it local, so you just confine yourself to Limerick and Tipperary.
Suppose, yeah. I was out there one time on a junket or whatever.
A visit.
But I found it extremely boring, to be honest with you. What I sat through, anyway, at the time. Is there a lot of stuff that's
There's a lot of target stuff, all right. I mean, there's, if you're on a committee that has, you have a great interest in. Now, I mean, everyone in the Irish setup are all on the agricultural committee, yeah, because yeah, they have to be. But, I mean, I was on consumer affairs as well, which is very interesting. And so you'd be trying to do stuff. And the only thing I will say is that sort of legislation that was in process when I was there is only coming to fruition maybe around now. Wow. So even you putting out, and your team would put out statements, and you'd go into all the papers and go into the journal and all the other radios and all of that. But like, people kind of got cynical after a while.
So it's a very slow moving.
Very slow moving, yeah. Because legislation from the European Parliament is slow, because it has to be checked in every sense.
Yes.
And it has to have, you have to have a base in fact. You have to be able to discuss it. You have to be able to,
and
you
every
know,
country then has
And every
an
country
input,
has an input, yeah. And what one country might want, like say we'd be an island, but like the other countries that have a bloc, they would have maybe different viewpoints. But yeah, Ireland was a little bit of an outsider, or an outlier, you might call it, without being a lawyer, I mean.
I'm fascinated by the whole thing, because it seems to me to be so huge. I wonder how you'd even read yourself into a brief in the 5 years.
Well, the whole brilliant thing about the staff that you'd have, there would be somebody in charge of each element of whatever committees you were representing.
Okay.
And then there would be a particular member of staff that would deal with home stuff. So they did all the press release for home and something that would have relevant locally or regionally or whatever. And then you'd have someone that did specifically putting up stuff about the European Parliament per se and what was discussed at committees. So you could write it all down and then just say to yourself, you have to stop at a point where you're going to be overloading people because they get sick of you very quickly. Like, say, there she's speaking about that again and whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting though. All right, let's have a look at some of the letters coming in then. The first one, dear Phil, my wife and I are in our late 40s and we have two children who are in their teens. My wife has recently started talking about having another child. She does this every so often, so I just thought it was another idea that she would have, but it would go away. But she's adamant this time round. She says her time for having children, is almost over and she wants to have one more. Because she never felt she was completely done with having children. For me, I think our family is perfectly fine the way it is. I hate the idea of going back to sleepless nights, nappies, and having no freedom. Not only that, but I'll be pushing 70 when that child goes to college. I think it would add too much pressure financially, and I was looking forward to travelling with my wife when the kids had gone to college. But that would be gone if we had another child. We're at a complete impasse on the issue. What should we do?
God, I have sympathy for both in this case. I can understand that the woman might want something, but realistically, once you get into the late 40s, fertility decreases dramatically. There is an increase in the possibility of having a child with a chromosomal abnormality like Down syndrome or Edwards syndrome or Turner syndrome. There is a difficulty even with pregnancy loss, early miscarriage, complications of high blood pressure. There's all sorts of factors that come into play the older you get. Difficulty in conceiving is another one because the woman is born with the amount of eggs she has for all of her life, and the quality of those eggs will decrease as people get older.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah. And I remember being quite fascinated when we were doing student nurse training, not even midwifery training, and finding that the amount of eggs that you have and the ability to conceive, you have them from the time you're born in your ovaries. So it's not as if they kind of
but
suddenly grow
created,
and
yeah.
just yeah decide to descend with all the angst and the moods and all the rest of it that goes with. So... So those eggs that would be remaining after that age would be more likely to have chromosomal abnormalities. They would have, it would make a healthy conception much more tricky. And the man makes a very valid point that he is going to be hitting 70. So is his wife going to be hitting nearly 70. I don't know if they've had any discussion with their teenagers about the possibility of having a little brother or a little sister, because I think that has a huge impact. And whilst they might be excited, they're going to be relatively parents to the younger child, because as you get older, there's all sorts of risks involved with putting yourself through that. And I would be strongly of the view that, you know, if they could make a decision, but I just think the risks are quite high for having a baby late in life. Now, Fran, I remember a lady of 52 years of age giving birth, and I will never forget it because she was in a ward, and it was a four-bedded ward, and the other three in that ward were two 18-year-olds and a 19-year-old. And the poor woman, she just kept the curtains around her, and that was very understood. She kind of was mortified. Now, she shouldn't have been mortified because, I mean, if you really, really want a baby, it doesn't matter when or how you get it. But, like, you do want to give the baby the best chance, but you also want to have the health, the energy and the focus to be able to look after a baby. And when you're nearing your 50s, I don't think that's the time to start a new life all over again, because we all know that there's a 20-year high-intensity input into that child. And you also have to factor in how much it costs to have a baby, because it's very significant.
But I presume that biological drive is very powerful, Phil, at whatever age.
It might be, but the biological drive might be there, but the physical support system might be on a wane.
Yes.
So if you're not in the very best of health, like the optimum time for having babies, believe it or not, is from late teens to early 20s. And when I was doing my midwifery, and so somebody having their first baby was referred to as a prima gravida, which means first time being pregnant. And you were an elderly prima gravida if you were over 25 years of age.
Wow.
So this woman is nearly twice this, and it's a, it is a risk, Fran. And I mean, it would, I think the possibility of having maybe counselling with somebody that's a fair expert,
yes,
would be a good idea. But I ultimately, my whole gut is telling me, I think this is dicey. It's different if somebody has had infertility and they eventually find that they're pregnant and it's late in life. And I mean, I have looked after people at 44, 45 that have had perfectly beautiful babies, absolutely beautiful babies. But I've seen them 10 years later as well, and they're pure withered because they haven't the energy to be galloping around after a little fella, you know, or a little one.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Fran, look, it's a very, it's a complex situation. I mean, I have to accept that the man thinks it would put too much pressure financially. And he had a plan for sort of enjoying the nicer side of life, like travelling with his wife, going different places. And definitely you can overlook the amount of equipment and what's involved if you're bringing a baby along with you, places that you can go, you know, have you someone that will mind the child? Is there, you know, that whole thing? It's a very, very, very big subject. And I know there are people listening to say, I would give anything to have a baby at whatever age if they've had problems with fertility. And I'm not doing that down, but I just think that the poor man has a complete worry about it. And he also has it within, now, I mean, and I'm not suggesting this for a second, but I mean, he could have been sterilised and she might know about it. But either way, it may not just happen.
Interesting. All right, thanks, Phil. The second letter then. My husband is in his 60s and always enjoyed a drink, but with the cost of everything, he stopped going out so much and we now drink at home. That's great, but the issue is that he is drinking much more than he did before. Most nights now, he will open a bottle of wine for dinner. Is this about me? And drink it over the rest of the evening. I used to join him for it last, but now I feel that every night is a bit much, so I will only partake at weekends. I mentioned to him before that he shouldn't be doing it every night, or maybe lay off during the week and just keep it for weekends, but he'll always find an excuse. A bad day at work, he wants to relax, he wants to celebrate, or he wants to try a new wine that he's got, but it's every night now. He never gets drunk, really, but I'm afraid he's becoming reliant on it. What should I do? Am I blushing?
No, you're not blushing. You see, I think that, look, it's something he does. It's very much, I think, a personal choice. But if people enjoy having a glass of wine in the evening, they should go for it. Now, perhaps every night is not the best idea, but if it's not doing him any harm and he doesn't get drunk and he doesn't abuse her or any of the rest of it, like, I don't think it's a big, huge sin. I would think that if she's worried and she also joins him in having a drink, why then is she judging him for having something that she helps
as
well?
She's pulled back and she only partakes at weekends herself.
Yeah, but you know, that's all very well, but he's kind of, it's almost like he's coming to the end of his day and, you know what, he opens and has a glass of wine with the dinner and it's enjoyable and he has, what, maybe two more glasses. I really don't think it's as big an issue as she thinks it is, but I suppose if he had a couple of nights off during the week, it wouldn't do him harm.
Mm.
But, like, it's kind of a very judgmental approach to have taken about something that has been going on for quite a while. I mean, you could go out and drink four or five pints and go home and you might decide to have wine then when you wouldn't be at all in your full senses. Whereas he's, you know what I mean? He did it for reasons of not going to the pub every night, and I really don't think it's a huge issue. Perhaps he should cut back during the week.
But are we not getting the impression that he's drinking a bottle? I feel such a hypocrite even talking about this. But anyway, are we not getting the impression that he drinks a bottle a night, though. Is that not sort of,
that's my understanding, Hugh, because of his talk. He's drinking much more than he did before. He'll open up. Now, most nights, he will open a bottle of wine for dinner and drink it over the rest of the evening.
Yes.
So, I mean, if you're having a bottle of wine and it's over 5 hours, I honestly don't think it's going to do any harm.
But what about all these people who tell you that the amount of units you should have over a week, and that it's
And Fran, you know what I mean? It makes sense that you would watch what you're doing, but I mean, I just think that the wife used to do everything and do everything with him and drink the wine with him, and now she's decided, and obviously she's decided for health reasons,
yes,
and
she's perhaps just concerned about him.
So perhaps it's no harm that he should look at his pattern, and maybe he should pick two wonderful wines every week that she said, I'm going to try that now on Sunday, and I will try another one then maybe Friday, and check him out and see what you think. But like, it's a personal choice, I think, you know. It would be better if he didn't drink every single night.
Okay. The final one then. Dear Phil, my daughter's 18, and last year for her TY ball, she decided to go on a tanning bed to get a nice colour for the ball. I was a bit wary at first because I have a lot of concerns about how safe they are, but I figured she'd just use it a couple of times and be done with it. The problem is, she hasn't stopped. She said she liked the colour it gave her and she preferred it to using tanning lotions, but I worry about the effect it will have on her health. I've spoken to her about it and shown her articles highlighting the dangers of sunbeds and the risk of cancer, but she says that I'm being dramatic. I really thought tanning beds are a thing of the past, and I do worry about her reliance on them. She goes now at least once a week. Is it really safe, or should I do more to dissuade her from using them? How do you feel about tanning beds?
I think that she's very silly to be using tanning beds, because there is such a selection of mousses and lotions and potions and sprays that you can get now that don't impact on your health and your skin in the same way as beds used to do. The very idea of going on a tanning bed now would absolutely just put me into the horrors.
Would it?
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, it's proven. It really does harm the skin. It really does put you at risk of skin cancer. It really does, you know, the protections you get from mousses and all the rest of it means you don't have to go out and bake in the sun. But it's just, you know, it's important to have a balance. Like, I don't even know where there would be tanning beds now. I think they're completely kind of gone out of fashion.
No, there's still a couple of places, yeah.
Yeah.
Says he knowledgeably.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know, but I think the mother is right to be concerned, and I think going to get a colour on a tanning bed is quite expensive for a start. Mm. It's much easier now.
That's what I was going to say. How does she afford it once?
Exactly. Yeah. So she should really consider just going and getting the lotions, potions, or mousses, or whatever she wants, or those gloves, or there's all sorts of stuff now you can do, and she look very, very well without harming her skin.
Okay, but she seems to be a strong-willed young lady, so
she might be. But you know, there are young ladies that get skin cancer from using sunbeds.
Yeah.
And it is a recognised thing. And I mean, not to harbour on just what's all negative. Sometimes you can feel very well, but because it can help with fibromyalgias and stuff like that. But so can medication, so can adjusting your lifestyle, so can cutting out certain foods. So it's to me, because there's so many other options that she can do, that to put herself at risk of getting a cancer of the skin is it's putting herself at risk.
But of course, when you're of a certain age, you think you're invincible to all of that.
You do, Fran, except that, I mean, there are so many people, and there's people listening that will say, you know, well, I got a mole and I thought nothing of it until it became itchy or raised or whatever. And then they go to the doctor, and then they're sent to a dermatologist, and then they have a biopsy, and then they're diagnosed with a melanoma. So, I mean, those stats are not there for the crack. They're there because they actually...
And with your medical background, you would say it's a no-no.
Absolutely no-no. And just going to say, I went on sunbeds in my youth.
Okay.
Now, I have enough skin for three faces now, and I probably should only have enough skin for two faces. Just saying, like.
But, of course, we didn't know, I suppose.
No, we didn't. Yeah. But, I mean, now there is... You see, with the internet and the range of information that's out there, you don't have to go to an expert or a doctor and the rest of it, because Dr. Google knows everything. But you have to be discerning as well about what you're reading. And if you're looking at peer-assessed...
reviews.
Yeah. You, at least you're going to get the, and I know it can be very technical and very whatever, but it's quite targeted at times actually, but you will still get the facets that you need to know, and when there is makeup you can put on that make you look as if you're out in the sun for a fortnight, isn't it great that it's not harming you whilst you're looking good?
Absolutely.
Or people think that brown fat is not as fat as white fat. And I mean, that's always been a kind of a thing. And it's true. Brown fat is better, like.
Oh, that's very good indeed. So, to that mom out there, anyway, try and dissuade her, I suppose.
I would kind of do more than that. She should
She's TY, so she's only, 16?
Yeah, but at the same time, like, somebody is supplying her with the moolah.
Absolutely.
To go off and have her tambed. So, I would be just saying, yeah, okay. I'm going to give you the same amount of money I want to save up and buy that lovely bag or that lovely shoe or other shoe or whatever.
It's always good to see you, Phil. Thanks very much indeed.
All right,
we're going to take a break. We're back with more Tip Today in just a moment.
Tip FM's Tip Today with Fran Curry.
In association with Slattery's of Pecan, Tipperary's main Peugeot dealer. Slattery's Garage Pecan, the name you can trust for over 50 years in the Premier County. Slattery'sGarage.ie.